Today, the United Nations 22nd General Assembly ended its 10th day of debate. This week also saw the conclusion of round one of high-level conferences between the attending foreign ministers on the outskirts of the UN grounds. Behind much of this talk and debate lurked the specter of Vietnam, United States policy there, and the posture of President Johnson. For an update report and reaction, here's Earl Fell, United Nations correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor.
The Big Four foreign ministers have finished talking at the UN, both publicly and privately. Nearly half of the annual State of the World speeches by international leaders have been heard at this time. Now, the General Assembly, at this stage every year, is dealing with words and hints rather than actions. Those words and hints this year may be summed up fairly briefly. On Vietnam, no progress in secret talks. Some new calls in public for an American bombing halt. One of them from our closest neighbor and ally, Canada. On the Middle East, no progress in public speeches. Some very cautious maneuverings in private for a new compromise. Eastern European allies of Moscow have been trying to urge Egypt to compromise beyond the openly pro-Arab Tito plan for a settlement, which Israel spurns at this time. American diplomats have been trying to keep Israel from complicating peace efforts by adding young settlers to its soldiers in occupied Arab territories. Britain is pushing hard to reopen the Suez Canal as a first step. On the question of ceding Peking, it's been largely a matter of the big powers ignoring the subject this year. On a better trade deal for poorer lands in the southern hemisphere, there has been persistent talk from the smaller powers. It's a much overlooked refrain that takes up almost as much time in the smaller power speeches as Vietnam. It is often linked to bitterness over the expensive new anti-missile race, the so-called anti-China missiles, which are to be deployed in the United States and the Soviet Union. Small wonder there's bitterness on this subject. Diplomats from Africa, Asia, and Latin America fear that the deploying of even limited ABM defenses will inevitably lead to a full-scale new missile race. This would cost tens of billions of dollars, $30 billion plus in the United States alone. Already, the poorer lands of the world have watched the Vietnam War eat up prodigious amounts of capital they feel might have been turned to help them at least enter the first industrial age as the United States and Europe move into the automation age. To date, they know, Vietnam has cost over $48 billion on just the American side since the war began to escalate in the early 60s. This is more than the entire amount of American economic aid to all nations on all continents since the end of World War II. To divert tens of billions to a new missile race is hardly popular among nations whom both Moscow and Washington are trying to persuade to sign a new non-proliferation treaty. But none of this rumbling is having any noticeable effect on the great powers. The Big Four continue to dominate the organization's progress, or lack of it, from start to finish. The private meetings of the Big Four foreign ministers resembled, as usual, a game of Manhattan hotel hopping. They talked in all possible two-man combinations in the Waldorf Towers, the Carlisle, the white brick Soviet mission on 67th Street, and all four of them together in Uthant's suite atop the UN Secretariat building. After that working dinner with Uthant, the Secretary General and all four of the ministers emerged smiling. But when Mr. Gromyko was asked if they had talked about Vietnam, his answer was a blunt no. And that pretty well summed up progress on Vietnam this week. Mr. Rusk showed no sign of budging on the bombing, despite a new rephrasing of the American position by Ambassador Arthur Goldberg last week. Mr. Gromyko showed no sign of wanting to talk further about the matter unless Mr. Rusk did budge. Mr. Thant, who has acted as a behind-scenes middleman and public goad to action on Vietnam for more than 3 years, has suspended his attempts in evident frustration. And other channels appear to be drying up as well, at least until they see some sign of yielding by one side or the other. I talked privately this week to one minister who has taken part in two substantial behind-scenes peace moves on Vietnam. He said, with a resigned shrug of his shoulders, that his country would not be trying again. "Twice burned, we quit," he muttered. but he added that his services were at hand if there ever seemed to be any hope of persuading either Washington or Hanoi to start talking again. For a subject that is not and will not be acted on by the UN, Vietnam has been getting more verbal attention this year than last. Probably the most significant change was Canada's careful call for an American bombing halt. This call was coupled to other steps. Ottawa said Hanoi would have to cooperate too. Some delegates saw it as partly designed for domestic Canadian political purposes. But when all was said and done, it was a call that made headlines in the United States, alongside of Senator Morton's attack on the administration. Any effect the Canadian move might have was, in fact, mainly in this field of headline impact on the American public. It had no discernible effect on Mr. Rusk or the administration. Canada also repeated its last year's departure from American policy, a call for seating Peking at the UN under a China plus Formosa policy. But it did so with little hope of success this year. In fact, many of Peking's backers among the larger powers have gone from lukewarm to near hostile in their support for China. Mr. Gromyko spared Peking's seating only one sentence in his long speech, and France's Maurice Couve de Mourville didn't even include that much support in his address. Arthur Goldberg didn't feel it necessary to give any space to opposing Peking this year, and George Brown continued British backing of the principle of seating, but accompanied it with complaints about the harsh treatment of the British mission in Peking. We shall probably be seeing some attempted moves on the Suez Canal and a UN mediator for the Middle East in coming weeks. But on those interlocking problems of Vietnam and China, the UN still finds itself going nowhere this week. Thank you, Earl Fell of the Christian Science Monitor.
Thank you, Earl. As the fall session of the UN continues, Earl will bring us frequent reports on events there and coverage of all of those of major importance. Speaking of events, a major one for one of New York City's major communities will occur on October 13th, when the new Lafayette Theater on 7th Avenue near 132nd Street opens its doors again as the first professional theater in Harlem in over 20 years. Some exciting plays are planned, and tonight we preview the fair at this newest addition to the Great White Way, or if you will, the Black Theater. For that purpose, we meet Robert Macbeth, artistic director for the theater, Mr. Lofton Mitchell, playwright and author of the book Black Drama, and Clifford Mason, playwright and theater commentator for WBAI Radio. Moderating is Dick Campbell, chairman of the Committee on Desegregating the Arts.
This business of the new Lafayette Theater opening, Mr. Macbeth, is very interesting to me because I remember the old Lafayette Theater, and I remember the things that we used to do there. Now, I don't mean to say that I was a part and parcel of the old Lafayette Theater as such, because that was a very long time ago. But I do remember coming in just about the end of the time that it got going. And then I was with what followed the Lafayette Theater, a something of a vaudeville theater that took place, and the Lafayette became a presentation house before it became later a church. But I was very interested to know why you were reviving the Lafayette Theater, the new Lafayette Theater, shall we say, how you were motivated in that direction, and what your reasons were for doing it. I rather think this would be very interesting. I'd like to know what you tell us.
From my own point of view, it's my personal reasons for being where I am are kind of funny. I spent perhaps 5 years as an actor in the professional theater, commercial theater. Mm-hmm. And I guess that the clearest event was a time during which I was acting in The Living Premise. It was an off-Broadway improvisational kind of show. And one Sunday afternoon, between the early show and the late show, I was sitting in one of the bars with a glass of scotch in my hand, chatting actor talk and everything. And the television set in they were playing the news, and the television set over the bar. And I happened to look up, and there was a flash thing, and the flash was about the four little girls getting killed in Alabama.
Yes.
And
yes.
There I was with a glass of scotch in my hand sitting in a village bar. And I don't know, I guess I must have kind of been caught by it. And so I went in to do the night show, and the whole idea was that, all right, I'm going to say something about this. I'm going to really cook with this little this little item. And it was an improvisational show, so I had a good deal of freedom to do what I wanted to do, and I really let them have it. I guess I must have scared half the audience to death. I changed the whole production around, wandering through the audience looking angry and everything. And at the end of it all, the great experience was that at the end of it all, everybody loved it. They applauded and applauded. They loved it.
What had
but
you
that
done?
That wasn't the intention. Oh, I don't know. I added all kinds of things to the show that were kind of black anger things.
Yes.
And it was in some kind of way to strike back or to hit out or something. But of course, in an off-Broadway theater, I imagine there was no black people in the audience. I don't remember there being any in the audience. And the audience loved it, but that wasn't the idea.
No.
The idea wasn't for them to have this great experience about it. The idea was for it to mean something. And then, later on, that was the last play I ever did. I left then and quit. But later, I thought about it, and one of the things that I realized about that time for me was that it was a time of grief, like, that, you know, we had suffered deaths in kind of like the family.
Well, this is a part of black anger.
Well, wait a minute, because you have to clarify, because this was not, I really wasn't angry. That anger was the only thing I had in those surroundings. That was the only thing I could be, was angry in that surrounding. But the point was that it wasn't an angry thing. It was a thing of grieving, really, and that I could only do that in an audience that was made up of people who were closer, people who felt it in the same kind of way I did. And at that point, I understood that if there were things that I wanted to deal with like that, I had to be in a theater that had a black audience for the most part. Where those kind of things were more.
And this sort of motivated you into setting up...
into moving back toward Harlem. I hadn't really thought about theater. I really thought I would leave theater totally. But I moved back toward Harlem, and things being as they were, the new Lafayette.
Had you any knowledge of what the old Lafayette people had done in the old days, and did this somehow enter into your, in a comparative way, to your thinking about the development of your current theater?
Yes, I knew some of what Miss McClendon and Canada Lee.
Yeah, I knew her very well.
Had done. I was most struck by Orson Welles's work.
Yeah.
The Lafayette during the WPA period,
yeah.
And particularly by his attitude towards the productions of things like Macbeth and The Mikado, all of which were kind of stock theater pieces, but which he took from the point of view of representing or relating to a black company and a black audience.
Lofton Mitchell has written a book, Black Drama. And he tells a great deal about what transpired in those days historically. But don't you have some sort of film here that will give us some indication of what your thinking was in building this and reviving this new Lafayette Theater, how what it meant to you, how you came to do it? What led you into it? Because what you've told me thus far was that you were motivated by the rebellion or the anger or that came as a result of this sensational thing that happened in the South. Well, but actually, the Lafayette Theater in those days was not built, was not angry. It was artistic, or it attempted in its way to be artistic, you know. So there was a great deal of difference, and I was wondering how you were tying that in with your...
Yeah, actually, if I may interrupt, the Lafayette was a Me Too theater, and it came into being as such. The idea behind it really was to show white folks that black folks can do what you do. It came into being actually because when Edward Sheldon's play The Nigger opened on Broadway in 1910, black people were not even allowed in the theater either as performer or patron. As a matter of fact, from 1910 to 1917, only one black artist worked on Broadway, and that was Burt Williams. And this is tied up with the development of Harlem as a black community. So black people had to go uptown to work in theater because the tide of reaction had set in. You remember the riots were going on then, and the birth of a nation came along, and the propaganda medium was and still is in high gear on an anti-black syndrome. Mm. And it was this reason that led black people to Harlem. And the Crescent Theater was the first theater to be started up there.
On 135th Street.
Yeah, 1909, where Lenox Terrace now sits. And like all Americans, we don't have a monument showing the Crescent stood here. That doesn't count in this country. No tradition, no roots. The Crescent went out of business because the Lincoln Theater next door started running cheap movies. And the Lafayette opened in 1912. Lester Walton and Eddie Hunter started producing plays. But they were largely Me Too plays. They were only successful in terms of
Well, musical. wouldn't you say that was because there were no plays by Negro playwrights as such that had been written? Nobody had done, let's come into the current playwriting syndrome, as you say. Nobody had written A Raisin in the Sun. Nobody had written Mr. Charlie. Nobody had written any of the Negro plays that had been produced on and off Broadway. There was precious little material. And so Clarence Muse, who was an actor of his day, had to don whiteface, he thought, to do Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And all these plays.
Actually, it doesn't really matter, Clifford Mason. I suppose, whether or not New Lafayette is not being true to the real tradition that the old Lafayette Theater created 20, 30 years ago. And I guess in a sense it would be rather naive to assume that it should be. Certainly we're in a new time, and Bob Macbeth and people like him stand for a new breed. And they're not trying in any way to do anything that's going to please the powers that be or the establishment of the people downtown. Mm-hmm. They're creating a theater for the community uptown. And probably from what I've understood in talking to Macbeth and other people, they don't care whether people from downtown come or not. If they do, fine. If they don't, it doesn't matter, because they're really gearing their theater to somebody uptown. I do feel, however, that just the fact that there was an old Lafayette Theater, that there is something that we can harken back to, that we can think of fondly, that's really all we need to do, to put any more pressure on it and look at it too closely and see whether or not it's consistently the same thing.
Yeah.
Sort of, really, you know, doesn't need to be done.
Now, if you want to, you know, if you want to go down this street, that's fine. Yeah, thank God it was there. But I think implicit in what Dick was saying, certainly what I'm trying to say, is that the whole communications media from the sabotage of the Reconstruction has been defined against the black American in sharp terms, and the nonsense that was written and produced and published since that time has been anti-black, and for that matter has been anti-white, but the white structure hasn't yet learned it. They've pseudo-learned it in terms of the labor movement and other things. But the American people got sold down the stream with the sabotage of the Reconstruction. And even the white groups back there weren't saying anything. So while the Lafayette said Me Too, the white groups did. You read that garbage that Clyde Fitch put out, and even that nonsense that O'Neill called The Emperor Jones or All God Chilling Guy Waits, those are bad plays. Just like Hello Dolly's a bad play. You know? I mean, so I think we have to get to the definition of things. And if Bob Macbeth, God bless him, is starting a new Lafayette Theater, let's start it and let's realize what we're bucking. And we're bucking a multi-million dollar communications media that's an arm of the power structure, the New York Times included.
Yeah. Wait. Now, one of the reasons I would like to clarify that I didn't start this theater out of any anger. No. I started this theater out of the realization of the limitations of anger. Mm-hmm. Now, the theater really, see, I agree with Lofton as far as the communications media is concerned. Mm-hmm. And what I feel is, as far as the arts are concerned, that Ed Bullins, who's one of the playwrights we're going to do this year, says a very interesting thing. He says, Leroy Jones is perhaps the most important person in the American theater in the last 25 years. Mm-hmm. And he says this for this reason, because the advent of Leroy Jones is moving back to Harlem with his black arts theater. Now, let's not mix up the concept with what the product finally was. Mm-hmm. Let's understand that the concept of moving the theater back to people,
yes,
not to the theater, but to people, to relating the theater to some people in mm-hmm. some kind of way, is really a kind of a new concept. It's a concept really that the theater generally has not understood. They have what's called regional theaters, which are absolutely not regional. at all. Mm-hmm. They're just New York theaters transplanted into other places. Mm-hmm. Nobody conceives of the fact that people in the Middle West or in the South or in the Far West or in the Northwest might be in tone, in sense, in feel different from the New York theater audience. Mm-hmm. And that theater perhaps, in relating itself to people in some kind of way, would be different in these places. Mm-hmm. Now, my feeling about the whole involvement in the theater, or what is called the theater now, is that for us, black people, it is absolutely imperative that we begin to form our own means of communicating with one another. And I'm not really talking about the media now, because media is another story. That's a very expensive.
I'm with you.
But that we begin to communicate now with each other so that all of the information passed around, all of the culture passed on, is not passed on through somebody else, that it's passed on by us. Mm-hmm. Through us.
I fully agree. I fully agree with you, Bob. The one reason I went into the history jag here is the greatest people's theater that came to this country was the WPA Theater. You named Canada Lee and Orson Welles and so on up at the Lafayette. The important thing to remember, though, is the powers that be saw the danger of a people's theater and sabotaged it when they killed the WPA by an act of Congress.
Yes.
And from that time, theater in America definitely became a middle-class luxury.
It did.
And exactly. You've seen the shrinking of even the Broadway houses and the astronomical prices. And the real attempt here is to keep people at the theater.
I want to ask you a question.
If some people actually went in there and knew what was going on the stage, well, they might tear up the place.
How black would you make your theater? That is to say, to what extent would the participation of white actors be involved in the theater?
To the extent that they're necessary for the purposes of productions.
Uh-huh.
Or to the extent that they're necessary for the purposes of expertise which aren't available.
Mm-hmm.
But, or to the extent of their desire to involve themselves if they're needed.
Yes.
But I wouldn't integrate anything for its own sake.
Let me get a word in here, Dick. So far as talking about black theater and what it should address itself to, I feel that one of the biggest things that black theater can do for the Negro people in general in America is to attack some of the misrepresentations that Negro people have suffered in terms of history, things that they have done.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that Alexander Hamilton was proven to be a mulatto from the West Indies, his mother had Negro blood in her. And that he had a brother who came over here who was so dark-skinned that he was segregated against in a restaurant. And this is on file in history books. All of the great slave rebellions, Gabriel Prosser, Nat Turner, Denmark Vesey. Lincoln's second vice president was a Negro. The fact that there were about 150 Negroes who held up in a swamp in Georgia for 12 years after the Civil War and who called themselves soldiers of the King of England, after the Revolutionary War, rather, before they could come and get him. The fact that a Negro troop routed a group of Texans who outnumbered them 2-1 at the Battle of Milliken's Bend.
Uh-huh.
All of these things are things which have been purposely buried and put under the rug. And it would really mean a rebirth or renaissance in terms of dignity and self-respect if this sort of thing could be done. Certainly one of the most glorious ages in English drama, not only because of his talent, but because of his material, was what Shakespeare did with the history of that country. And if we can get that here, in addition to all the other things that are going, I think we'll be on the road to a real rebirth.
I think we all agree that there's a tremendous amount of material, historical material, involving a Negro that has never been done in the theater. And we look forward to getting some of this from the New Lafayette Theater, Mr. Macbeth. And if you read Lofton Mitchell's book, Black Drama, you'll find a lot of material in that. It'll do us good. I think our time is about up now. We still have about a minute. Have you something additional to say about the opening of your show?
The theater is free, and it's free to the public. Not just to the members of the community.
You got a good point.
And
in Harlem especially.
one can call the theater and reserve tickets, of course.
Yes.
For performances, which are 5 times a week. And I hope everyone who involves themselves in the theater as an audience enjoys it.
I'll be down there to criticize the plays and review them. I can tell you that. I'm dying for the season to open.
And the theater is in 132nd Street and 7th Avenue. And if you were a commercial theater, we wouldn't even tell the people where you were located unless you paid us.
How about that?
This is what you get on NET.
How about that? Good luck, Bob. It's a great venture.
Good.
Thanks a lot, Bob.
Good to see you.
Thank you, Mr. Campbell. Thank you, Mr. Macbeth, Mr. Mitchell, and Mr. Mason. New York City and environs depends for much of its electric, gas, and steam power on the public utility known as Consolidated Edison Company. And like all such unique enterprises, Con Ed is constantly open to public scrutiny and sometimes to public criticism. But like its slogan, Dig We Must, the folks at Con Ed approach such inquiry with a good deal of resignation. The latest of these inquiries has been launched by the Mayor's Council of Consumer Affairs and addresses itself to the rates charged the public for electricity. Here to respond to our questions on this apparently debatable subject is Charles F. Luce, Chairman of the Board of the Consolidated Edison Company. Mr. Luce, who has held that post just since last August 1st, is a former Undersecretary of the Department of the Interior. Mr. Luce, in your view, why is the city at this time embarked on this investigation of your rate structure?
Well, Mitchell, I'm not sure just why the Deputy Mayor Costello has announced that he's going to investigate not only our rates, but whether we're providing adequate protection against future blackouts and whether we're providing future power supply to meet the needs of the city in the 1970s. However, I have agreed with Mr. Costello that while the city does not have regulatory authority, that authority lies in the state, that whatever we do at the Consolidated Edison Company is a subject of great interest to the city, and possibly this is the reason that Mr. Costello has announced his investigation or study. I don't think he's called an investigation.
You expressed some surprise and from the press report some chagrin at the fact that this investigation had been suggested or partially undertaken and that you were not informed of it in advance.
Well, maybe the surprise came because I heard about it on Sunday morning at 11 o'clock when I was about to go out for my weekly Sunday bicycle ride. And I got a call from one of the network stations informing me of the broadcast by Mr. Costello and inviting me down to respond. And under those circumstances, I think you can understand I was a little surprised, but I went. I went down to respond.
Well, let's talk about your rates for electric power. Now, according to the information that the city has made available, electric power costs in New York rank higher than cities like Philadelphia and Boston per kilowatt hour. Is this correct?
It certainly is correct. Mr. Costello used Philadelphia, I believe, as his principal example, and our rates are substantially higher than those in Philadelphia.
Why is that?
Well, basically because our cost of doing business in New York City is higher than the cost of doing business if you're an electric utility in Philadelphia. For example, the cost of construction in Philadelphia is about 20% less than it is here. The Philadelphia utility uses 75% coal and doesn't have the anti-pollution devices that we have on our generating plants. We burn only 40% coal, and we burn premium coal, and we have precipitators, and all of this costs a great deal of money. But the big difference is in taxes. If we paid taxes in New York City on the same basis that Philadelphia Electric pays in Philadelphia, we'd pay about $36 million a year, local and state taxes. Instead, we pay $160 million. If we paid taxes on the same basis as the utility in Philadelphia, we could roll back our electric rates to where they were 15 years ago in 1952.
Well, some people have implied, perhaps they're not among your fans, that that Con Ed could live with a lower rate of profit than it presently has, and that in a sense, if your operating expenses were not as high on the administrative level, perhaps, that these costs could be shaved.
Well, our rate of profit, our rate of return, is the lowest of any of the major electric utilities in the United States, much lower, for example, even than the utility in Philadelphia or the utility in Chicago. It's now about 5.5% on each dollar that we have invested, whereas we have to pay for new money that we borrow to build new generating plants and anti-pollution devices and all that sort of thing, over 6%, about 6.3%. Now, as to whether we can reduce our costs, I think every utility constantly has to be trying to reduce its costs, just as every other business does, and we're taking some measures to try to do that, just as we have in the past and as we'll continue to do in the future.
One of the points that's come up so frequently is that the public seems aware of a large amount of advertising on the part of Con Ed, which is a monopoly for those customers who must use electric power in the areas where you operate. And the question has arisen, why such a large expenditure for the area of public relations? Would that money not be better used to reduce the cost of electricity?
Well, I think that certainly a certain amount of advertising by a utility is necessary to sell its product. We believe that we should inform the public of the advantages of electric heat, for example, or of other uses of electricity and of gas, which we also sell. And to a certain extent, I think we're justified in so-called public relations advertising. But I think probably we've done a little more of that than we should. We are going to run, I should say, a rather large ad next, if you want to call it an ad, next week, called a report to the people of the City of New York and Westchester County, in which we tell them what our goals and aims are, confess that we aren't doing as well in some areas as we expect to do and hope to do. You might call that public relations, but I think that the people are entitled to know what we're trying to do at the Edison Company, and if it costs us money to publish these ads in the newspapers, I think that this money well spent, because the public is entitled to know what we're doing.
What is your advertising and public relations budget for a year at Con Ed?
Well, you know, I've been there two butts, Mitchell,
and
I'm going to have to confess that I don't know what it is.
Yes.
I know that when next year's budget comes up, I will look over this item with great care.
Let's talk for a moment about gas rates, Mr. Luce. Many radio listeners in New York, perhaps, and newspaper readers have been aware of an intensive advertising campaign by the oil industry to indicate that oil heat is far cheaper than gas and more efficient and so forth. What is your response to this?
Well, I think the response is to be found in the selections made by new home builders is between gas, electric, and oil heat in our service territory. About 99% of the new homes are either heated with gas or electricity, and the other 1% with the other fuel. Now, of the 99% that we sign up, my recollection is about 15% are heated electrically, and the rest of them, what would that be, 84%, by natural gas. We hope to introduce and expect to introduce a lower promotional electric heat rate to increase this use of electricity for heat.
Mm-hmm. Gas is more expensive, though, than oil.
No, and gas is not more expensive than oil.
You are competitive in that.
Well, we think we are. Now, I suppose the oil sellers wouldn't agree with that, but when you take into account everything, including the cost of cleaning your furniture and your furnace rather, and the cost of keeping the draperies clean and repainting the house and so forth and so on, we think that gas is competitive with oil on a price basis and better in some other ways too.
We've probably started a new controversy here that we'll have to
provide
equal
time. Oil producer,
yes. I want to talk finally about the question of monopoly with regard to Consolidated Edison. In a sense, you are a monopoly, are you not, in the areas in which you operate?
In the territory that we serve, we are a monopoly. That's correct. By law, the laws provide that we are.
Well, now, why is it that the city has no power to regulate or control the monopoly in the area of city use? That, for instance, the water is controlled by the city and sold to the public.
Well, it's been customary, I think, in nearly all of the states of the union that electric utilities are regulated by the states rather than by the cities. And I think the reason is that most utilities, including the Edison Company, serve in more cities than one. For example, we serve not only in New York City, but also in a number of cities and villages in Westchester County. And it would be a somewhat chaotic situation if every city and village and town in which we served undertook itself separately to regulate our rates and practices. And the same thing is true in other states of the union as to other utilities. Consequently, the pattern has been state and more federal regulation of electric utilities.
I suppose the public is concerned because they consider you to be a public utility, and yet they have a sneaking feeling that you're also free enterprise and private.
Well, we are private. We're not free enterprise in the classical sense of the term, but we're a regulated monopoly, I think is the way to express it most accurately.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us this evening, Ms. Luce of the Consolidated Edison Company.
Thank you, Mitchell.
While Con Ed sits patiently before the combined attention of the city and the public, a new play is having a different kind of problem at Yale University. Tony Geis reports.
The Yale Drama School's new repertory season opens with the well-known 17th century tragedy called "'Tis Pity She's a Whore." It opens October 16th. Rehearsals are going well, but they're having a little trouble advertising it in some of the local papers, Variety reveals. This dignified subscription ad, about the whole Yale season was submitted to the New York Times, the Bridgeport Post, the Hartford Courant, and the New Haven Register. The Times and Post ran it unchanged, but the Hartford Courant phoned the drama school saying it objected to one word and eventually ran the title as, "'Tis Pity She's Blank Blank," leaving it still unclear which word was objectionable. The daring of the New York Times in printing the ad unchanged should be underlined. In 1958, they censored an ad for the same play in an off-Broadway production to read, "'Tis Pity She's an asterisk, asterisk, a W asterisk, 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 asterisk." Either the Times has a new policy, or it will take from Yale what it won't from off-Broadway. But the New Haven Register takes this year's prize for creative censorship. It simply renamed John Ford's 350-year-old Jacobean classic as 'Tis Pity She's Bad, which sounds like an episode from the Patty Duke Show, or an early Sophia Loren movie. And it's not just bad scholarship, it's unimaginative where a simple euphemism like 'Tis pity she's a fallen woman, or a fille de joie, if you like French, would have done the trick. Or better, an equally shocking phrase from the idiom of popular television, say, oh, 'Tis pity she has bad breath, or 'Tis pity her laundry is gray, or even 'Tis pity she's smoking more and enjoying it less. Variety didn't give the reasoning behind this censorship, but it usually involves being a family newspaper that children read. And who has forgotten the boyhood thrill of leafing hotly through the paper looking for a dirty repertory ad? Well, if the kids in Hartford and New Haven were searching for one this week, they didn't find it. They did find these healthy, highly educational type family ads for honest, clean burlesque shows, girly shows, and sexy movies in the Register and in the Current. But none of your dirty English literature. Those ads and the TV listings for action shows featuring glandular Los Angeles blondes with custom noses and bedroom eyes should keep the kids' minds off suggestive things like the title of a classical play. And that's your family newspaper for you, sometimes known as the Evening Double Standard. And if that's a family newspaper, you worry a bit about the newspaper and about the family. Or as John Ford might have put it, 'tis pity. This is Tony Geis.
Thank you, Tony. Now, in a moment, we'll have a look ahead to next week's news front, but before we sign off, a late review of news and weather, here again is Milt Haines.